have the following property, where that there, that they're anti-commutators. That their anti-commutators are linear combinations of energy and momentum. Okay? And for that to be possible, it's necessary, in order to preserve Lorentz invariance, that the supercharges transform in a spinorial representation of the Lorentz group in four dimensions. So not all of you, I don't know everything about spinners, so I'll just give a very lightning review how this works. So in four dimensions, there's a set of gamma matrices, gamma mu, with the property that gamma mu anti-commuted with gamma nu is equal to 2 times eta mu nu. I'll be using the convention where eta mu nu is negative 1 plus 1 plus 1 down the diagonal. Okay. Now, the four-dimensional representation of this, which I'll write down, is a reducible representation. It's the minimal size representation in four dimensions. And then these gamma matrices all anti-commute with a fifth chirality matrix. Okay. And our Weyl spinners will take to project it onto positive eigenvalues of the chirality matrix. Okay. So when we say a minimum amount of supersymmetry in four dimensions, we really mean one Weyl spinner. Okay. We really mean one Weyl spinner of supercharges. So you can think of this as a Dirac spinner with half of its components projected out. So this representation is two complex dimensions, and so the minimum amount of supersymmetry in a Lorentz invariant theory in four dimensions is four Hermitian supercharges. So there are four Hermitian linear combinations of these supergenerators. Okay. Now, let me begin by saying a little bit about what supersymmetry does in lower dimensions. Okay. So in lower dimensions, we can study very simple model systems. Okay, so we can study a system with even a single Hermitian supercharge. Okay, so we have a supercharge Q, and then the only in 0 plus 1 dimensions, the only energy momentum component for the supercharges to anti-commute onto is just the Hamiltonian itself. So the commutation relation is Q squared equal H. So now let's see what kinds of theories are allowed by this. Well, I think it's pretty evident that anything, okay, so if Q, remember Q is Hermitian, so if Q is diagonal. Q can be diagonalized. And so in the basis where it's diagonal, Q squared is just obtained by squaring the diagonal elements. Okay. And the anti-commutation relations tell us that those squares of lambdas are equal to the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. Okay, so first off, this tells us that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian in a supersymmetric theory is positive definite. Positive semi-definite, okay. So that means that it cannot have any negative eigenvalues. And yeah, by the way, I should just mention that when I'm talking about supersymmetric theories in four dimensions, I will always be talking about theories in which gravity is decoupled, so in which there's no gravity. Some of the statements I'm making will not be strictly true in theories where we have a dynamical metric. I just want to keep that in mind. For instance, this statement is not true in theories with a dynamical metric. There can be supersymmetric theories with negative energy in gravitational theories. But that's not what I'll be talking about. And you can also see that this is pretty much a complete characterization of theories with minimal supersymmetry in 0 + 1 dimensions of supersymmetric minimal supersymmetric quantum mechanics theories. Okay, if you take any Hamiltonian with the non-negative eigenvalues, then you can always define a supercharge Q, which squares onto it. In fact, there are many such choices. You could put in signs. So there's a choice of sign. Oops, sorry, over here. There's a choice of sign for every non-negative eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. You might think theories with just this amount of structure, not very interesting. So let's add another layer of structure, one which is motivated by higher dimensions. So in higher dimensions, anything in any Lorentz invariant theory, anything which transforms in a spinorial representation of the Lorentz group, you can change its sign, and the theory you get is always invariant. It just corresponds to doing a 2 pi rotation about some axis. Okay, so in higher dimensions, this corresponds to changing the sign of all the fermions. Now, there's nothing that forces us to have such a symmetry in a supersymmetric quantum mechanics model like this, but certainly anything which is obtained by dimensional reduction from higher dimensions will have this property. So let's impose this symmetry. Okay, and since Q alpha transforms as a spinner, this also means that Q in our model should be odd under this C2 symmetry. Okay. So this is the extra layer of structure which will allow you to start learning quite a bit. In the language of supersymmetry, this is called an R symmetry, a discrete symmetry like this is sometimes called R parity. But it's just a global symmetry under which the supercharge is left, is transforms non-trivially, and which commutes with the Lorentz group, and which is preserved by the theory in question. Okay, so I don't know what R stands for. Where does that come from? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know where R comes from. That's a good question. More questions like that. Very good. Okay, so this symmetry, we'll call it G, or we can also call it minus one to the F. Even though this name for it will become a little bit more motivated later on, but there doesn't have to be a continuous symmetry under which the supercharge transforms in order for you to define this G parity operation, okay? But if there is, then it's just minus one to the generator of the continuous symmetry, okay? So let's suppose that we have this symmetry with the following properties: that G squared is equal to one, it's a Z2 symmetry, that the supercharge anti-commutes with this operation, and that automatically means that the Hamiltonian commutes with it. So it's automatically conserved if the supercharge transforms in a definite way like that. Okay, so let's impose this, and now let's diagonalize this Hamiltonian into eigenstates of G. Okay, so we will not assume that there are the same number of eigenstates, and in fact we're going to see that it's the difference between the number of positive and negative eigenstates that determine some important things about the dynamics of the theory. Okay. So now, in this basis, so keeping to this basis, let's see what Q has to look like. So Q, well, what does it do? So we know that Q takes a state with, so let's say we have a state with eigenvalue plus 1. We know that Q has to take that state to a state of eigenvalue minus 1, and vice versa. Okay. So we have a state here, and we know that that has to take us to something, that Q has to take us to something down here. Okay. Well, actually, let's arrange it symmetrically to make it easy to see what happens. It has to take it down here, and basically Q will reflect states across the diagonal this way. Okay. Now we also know what the magnitudes of these matrix elements here are. So this is square root E1, this is square root E2, and so on. So, and then here's square root of E2 down here, square root of E1 down here. Okay, so particular, we know that this is true for states where G doesn't annihilate, where Q does not annihilate the state. We know that states have to be paired this way. But for states where Q does annihilate the state, there's no argument about pairing like this. Okay. So we're going to leave a little bit of room down in the corner here for just a few zeros. And some number of them. Okay, so the number of non-zero energy states, the number of positive energy states here is n positive, and that's an even number. Okay, it's an even number because every bosonic positive state is paired with a fermionic positive state. By bosonic and fermionic, I'm just referring to the eigenvalues of G. Okay, and then here's some number down here. So number zero bosonic and number zero fermionic. Now, there are a couple of things you can say. The first is that the eigenvalues of G are integer. Okay, so G has integer eigenvalues. Yeah.
Now Q is transforming as a spinor?
Q is just transforming as odd under this Z2 symmetry. I mean, there's only a single Hermitian supercharge down in this model theory in 0 plus 1 dimensions. It's not a spinner, but the reason that we're having it be odd is because, you see why, because it inherits a...
There's one Hermitian supercharge.
There's one Hermitian supercharge, which is odd. There's one Hermitian supercharge, which is odd because that's the way that supercharges in higher dimensions have to transform under a 2π rotation, which always commutes with a Lorentz invariant, which always acts is conserved in a Lorentz invariant action. Okay, so so the first observation is that G has integer eigenvalues. So in particular, trace of G is an integer. Okay. And that means that trace of G is invariant. Under continuous deformations. Of anything. So, in other words, if you vary this whole structure, if you vary the operators Q and G and H, keeping all of these relations among them, you will inevitably find that the trace of G is constant under those deformations because you can't continuously vary integers into other integers. Okay. The second observation is that the high energy states, the non-zero energy states, don't contribute to the trace of G because they always come paired. Okay, so higher eigenvalues, non-zero eigenvalues. Non-zero eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian compared with opposite eigenvalues of G. So it's only the zero energy states which contribute. To trace of G. Okay. So this tells you a couple of very interesting things. Okay, so first of all, trace of G is always computable just by looking at the low energy part of the theory. Okay, this is extremely important. Okay, this is the sort of the primary conceptual building block that allows you to actually solve complicated higher dimensional supersymmetric theories. It's the idea that one doesn't have to know complicated microscopic details of what the theory is doing in order to understand certain things about the theory, in particular some of these invariants like trace of G. And that you can also compute these things by taking the theory, going to low energies, and looking at some effective theory which may be simpler to understand. Okay, so this is really a key idea that we're going to be coming back to many times. Two, if trace of G is non-zero, the vacuum energy vanishes. Okay, because non-zero energy states come paired, any contribution to trace of G must come from one of the zero energy states. Okay, and that means that there cannot be any kind of classical or quantum zero-point energy at all. So this is something very useful. It tells us what's the eigenvalue of the lowest state of the Hamiltonian, and it's also of a lot of physical interest, since the vacuum energy of our universe is zero to a very good approximation. Okay, so many people have thought that this has something to do with supersymmetry. Whether or not it actually does, it's never really become clear, especially since it's become more and more clear that the vacuum energy is not exactly zero. Okay, so maybe never mind about that. But it's still worth mentioning. Okay. And the third thing is that since trace of G is deformation invariant, deform it. Deform the Hamiltonian. Deform whatever you want to solve the theory. Okay, so it's really 1 and 3 together are extremely powerful powerful things which will allow us to compute this quantity trace of G in a wide range of theories. Okay, because by deforming and going to low energies, you can really reduce almost arbitrarily complicated systems to extremely simple ones. And in particular, if you can ever take a supersymmetric theory and deform it and then use low energy methods to show that this trace of G is non-zero, then you know that the vacuum energy is non-vanishing in that theory and that the supercharges annihilate the ground state. Okay, and among other things, that makes it of no phenomenological interest whatsoever, since our current universe really is not supersymmetric, as we'll see when we get up to 4 dimensions. But oh, you go through many many phase transitions. Yeah, that's true. You can never change the index. Let me say you do have to be careful about what you mean by smooth deformation. That much is true. But just going through a phase transition is not enough to change the index. In fact, in the theory I'm hoping we'll get to today, there really is a transition. I mean, the strongly coupled behavior is nothing at all like the perturbative behavior, but the index is conserved. So Yeah, so let me just say, there is a caveat, though, that has led to some incorrect conclusions sometimes, if people ignore it, which is that, so the violations of trace G, so trace G changes, always have to do with large distances in field space. So they have to do with, you know, some kind of one-point functions that diverge. So typically, phase transitions of the ordinary kind have to do with one-point functions of some operator that discontinuously changes from zero to non-zero at a transition. But that by itself generally won't change the index. It's only when VEVs become divergent that you get these changes in trace of G. That's one thing to watch out for, but usually it's not something to worry about. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about representations of supersymmetry. So the way the supercharges act. So we've seen how supersymmetry acts on states in the Hilbert space. Now let's take a look at how supersymmetry can act on fields. So the theories we'll look at, we'll all define them as weakly coupled field theories with some interactions. Okay. So weakly coupled field theories. So let's take our 0 plus 1 dimensional model just as an example. So you have a Hermitian supercharge Q, and let's say you have some field which you'll call X. Okay. So you can just define that to be something. Okay. Usually you can call it psi. This is always a good way to start out. And now, in this case, okay, that automatically tells you what the supersymmetry transformation of psi is. Okay. It has to be X dot by the Bianchi identity. Okay. Sorry? What that tells you is just that Q acting on Q acting on something has to be negative, or has to be the Hamiltonian acting on that something, and that has to be negative I times the time derivative of that something. Okay, and this is really the way that you build linear representations of supersymmetry. Okay, so let's go to a slightly more interesting case, which is still quantum mechanics in 0 plus 1 dimensions, but where there are two Hermitian supercharges. So this case by itself, with one Hermitian supercharge, really is kind of impoverished theory. It too little supersymmetry to really forbid anything. So let's take a theory with slightly more structure. So let's have two Hermitian supercharges, or one complex supercharge. Okay. And so this algebra is defined by the property that both supercharges are equal to the Hamiltonian, and they anti-commute with each other. Okay. So now let's look at representations of of this algebra on fields. So let's start again with a Hermitian operator x, which we'll think of as the coordinate x in the quantum mechanics system. And now we'll act on it with q. And again, we'll give that thing a name. That's all it is. So there's really no content to that commutator. Then the hermeticity properties tell you that Q dagger acting on X has to be negative I times the conjugate of that. Then we can just derive from Bianchi identities and the original algebra the way the other operators that you've generated here have to transform. So Q psi and Q dagger psi dagger have to vanish. And again, using Bianchi identities, you find that Q dagger psi and has to be equal to X dot plus I times something Hermitian, we'll call it R, and then Q psi dagger has to be X dot minus I times that same Hermitian thing. And again, you know, this is just algebraic. Really the statement is that the sum of these has to be X dot, and that's equivalent to those two statements there. And by the way, from now on, whenever I write Q acting on an operator, that's just going to be defined as the anti-commutator for a bosonic operator. The commutator for a bosonic operator and the anti-commutator for a fermionic operator, curly O. Okay. Just to save writing. And now, okay, so now from this, you know, what do we do with it? Well, from what we have so far, we can use this to find a trick to build supersymmetric actions. Okay, so how do we do that? Well, let's take the following observation. If you act with Q and then with Q dagger on something, on anything. So act with Q and act with Q dagger on curly O. So call that curly L for Lagrangian, because that's how we want to think of it. We find that Q dagger of L is 0, and Q of L is a time derivative. So in particular, if we take any operator at all, curly O, and we act on it with Q dagger and Q, and then maybe take its Hermitian conjugate if we want to get something real, that curly L that we get, okay, so let's say plus Hermitian conjugate, but that's not so important, that curly L that we get is a suitable Lagrangian for a supersymmetric theory. Because Q acting on it and Q dagger acting on it both give 0 up to time derivatives, okay? And total time derivatives don't matter in a Lagrangian, okay? So because they don't affect the equations of motion, okay? So with these representations of supersymmetry that we've built up, we can go ahead and write down some actions, okay? So let's take, for instance, curly O equal to psi dagger psi, just because I know that this is going to work out to something that we want. So Q acting on this is equal to negative psi dagger, is equal to X dot minus IR times psi, okay? And then Q dagger acting on the above, is X dot minus IR, X dot plus IR, minus I psi dot dagger psi. which is x dot squared plus r squared minus I psi dot dagger psi. Okay, so right here you can see that this is, you know, plus time derivatives, which we don't care about because we're building Lagrangians here. We don't care about total derivatives. So we can see that we have the standard kinetic term for boson X, the standard kinetic term for the fermion psi, and then this R squared term. And so R, we still don't know what it is. It's just something that we've given a name to. Its identity is not determined by the supersymmetry algebra. So we can just leave it a completely undetermined thing, leave it whatever it wants to be, which means let's make it dynamical. And it's something with no kinetic terms, so we should think of it as an auxiliary field.
Okay. And this R is time independent?
No, it's not time independent. It has no time. Its time derivatives don't enter the Lagrangian, is what I mean when I say it has no time derivatives. There are no explicit R dot terms that appear in the Lagrangian. That doesn't mean it's time independent, and it won't be. We'll see in a second. At least if we take this to be our Lagrangian. But it will be determined algebraically in terms of other things in the problem by its equation of motion. Okay, and then so its time derivatives will be determined by whatever it's set equal to be. So now, if we just eliminate R by its equations of motion, so if we just take this to be our Lagrangian, the equations of motion say R equals zero, and we have a Lagrangian describing a free, two free degrees of freedom, so x dot dot equals zero, and psi dot equals zero. You quantize these in the standard way. Okay, so the massless boson, by which I just mean a zero frequency coordinate x and a zero frequency fermionic coordinate psi. Now, this theory is not so great by itself. If we wanted to compute its index, trace G, we wouldn't really be able to because the field space X is non-compact. Okay, so if X is non-compact, there isn't really anything to compute. So large distances, divergences in field space are the only things which can vitiate some of these theorems or make some of these quantities ill-defined. But then if we were to periodically identify X, we could get away from that. Okay, and then we'd see that the index is zero. Because there's only one zero energy state of the bosonic piece X, and two zero energy states of psi, because we know that the commutators of psi from this Lagrangian are just psi dagger with psi equals one, but psi carries no energy. So there are two states of this fermionic oscillator, both of which have no energy, one of which is bosonic, one of which is fermionic, so trace of G is zero. Okay. Now, let's perturb this Lagrangian. So perturb it. So let's do it in a supersymmetric way. So let's perturb that operator curly O that we acted on with Q dagger and Q. So let's add to this curly O, let's add a term omega squared x squared over 2.
Okay.
So now when we act with Q daggering Q, we'll find that what this adds to the Lagrangian is R x is one thing, and then it adds omega squared R x, and then it also adds a term omega squared psi dagger psi. Right. So it does. Sorry. And I don't want omega squared, I want omega. Omega psi dagger psi. So it adds a mass term for the fermions, or a non-zero frequency piece for the fermions, and it also adds something which couples to this auxiliary field. So go back and solve equations of motion for R again. And you get R equals negative omega x. And so this gives rise to a potential. V of x is omega squared x squared over 2. And so you have a mass term for the boson and a mass term for the fermion. Okay. So now let's compute the Witten index in this theory. Okay, but now we know that there can be at most one zero energy state. Okay. And we will find that it's bosonic. So that means that in this theory, in the perturbed theory, trace of G is just equal to plus 1. Okay. So now you're probably all scratching your heads and saying, wait a second, you started out with this theory where the index was 0, and then you ended up with a theory where the index was 1, and you just proved that you couldn't possibly do that deformations always leave the index invariant. Well, let's see exactly what went wrong. Okay. What went wrong was that the index is ill-defined if you let the coordinate x be non-compact, because there is an infinite integration over the x-coordinate, which is undamped. There's a continuum of low-energy states down at 0. So defining that trace just becomes a problem. But if we periodically identify x, then we won't be able to write down this operator curly O equals omega x squared over 2. Okay, so that wouldn't be a good operator in the theory if the coordinate x were periodically identified. Okay, so this sounds like just weaseling out of something, but let's see what happens if you actually add something which you can add in the periodically identified theory. So instead of x squared over 2, let's add sine squared x over 2. Okay, or let's add sine x over 2. Actually, that's better. So now, what is the potential now? Well, so now we go through this process of acting with the supercharges, and we get Q dagger on delta curly O is R cosine X. Then we eliminate R, and we get R is equal to negative cosine X. Okay, and so the potential is cosine squared X. So there's there's what looks like a massive vacuum, a massive zero energy vacuum. Massive zero energy vacuum at x x equal to pi over 2. Right? But now look at what the fermionic terms give you. So fermionic terms give you sine x times psi dagger psi. Okay. And that means you get a non-zero vacuum energy. Where you thought there was a zero energy vacuum. So remember that this fermion has a zero point energy which it contributes. Okay, so the energy isn't really zero at this classical vacuum. You'll find that the zero point energies of the bosonic and fermionic degrees of freedom don't cancel each other, and in fact, the vacuum energy is positive.
Yes, so just to understand what you said is that actually the states are normalizable in the feature where you added x squared over 2?
That's right. The states are normalizable because the wave functions are damped out at high values of x. Okay, you get the usual Hermite polynomial form for the wave functions, and then so you might say what happens? Okay, I guess you could ask what happens if you just keep the non-identified theory and let omega go to zero. Oh, okay. So what happens is that you get a zero energy state sort of coming in from infinity. Let me think. That's not right. What does happen if you take that limit? I'm wrong. I'm wrong. What happens is that really there is in that limit just a state which you can follow from non-zero omega. Okay, so I mean there really is sort of morally, I guess, a supersymmetric vacuum in that case. But there's another vacuum which comes down from zero. You have these two fermionic degrees of you have this one fermionic degree of freedom, and so psi has two states. So it has plus and minus, you know, so something where psi is excited and something where it isn't. So in this vacuum, psi contributes omega over 2. In this vacuum, psi contributes minus omega over 2. And so the boson x contributes plus omega over 2. Okay, so you have this vacuum where psi is excited and x is in its ground state, which is just going down to zero. So yeah, I'm sorry. In this case, it isn't literally an issue of a vacuum going out to infinity in field space, but the failure of the Witten index still is, you know, associated with large distances in field space. I mean, if insofar as x is compactified, either sort of dynamically with a mass term or with an explicit identification, you can make this argument precise just by, you know, by the heat kernel method, something like this, and you can really define this trace. And when x is non-compact and doesn't have an energy, you can't. So in the 5 minutes I have left, I want to at least set up the gauge theory, which the simplest possible supersymmetric four-dimensional gauge theory, which we'll be looking at, and then try and show you today and tomorrow how you can compute the index in that theory, and then try and go from there to understanding some more general methods like that. So four dimensions. Okay, what I'm not going to do is set up superspace and all that, you know, machinery of supersymmetric gauge theory. Right now, I just want to show you that the simplest possible example you can construct very concretely. So in four dimensions, you have a gauge field A and a fermion lambda alpha in the adjoint, so a Weyl fermion in the adjoint representation. Of the gauge group and the Lagrangian is just the obvious thing. It's 1 over g squared times trace 1 over, I guess, 4g squared trace f mu nu. And then plus just the minimal kinetic term for the Weyl fermion lambda. Oh, and I want to mention, okay, so when I say Weyl fermion, just take the convention that lambda has opposite chirality to Q. So in the convention we've taken, gamma lambda equals minus lambda. Okay. Now that statement's meaningless by itself because, you know, you can always, in four dimensions, you can always take the conjugate of lambda and you get a fermion of the opposite chirality. But we want to identify the U1 charge under which this lambda transforms with a U1 which rotates those Qs. Okay, so Q alpha and lambda alpha have the same U1 charge, an opposite chirality. Okay. That statement is meaningful, okay, and it just comes from this theory being supersymmetric, basically because the supersymmetry transformation of the gauge field has to have a gamma matrix in it, okay, in order to preserve Lorentz invariance, so you end up getting the opposite chirality from the supercharge. Okay, so this is just a very simple Lagrangian. It's really the only renormalizable Lagrangian you can write down up to the choice of a mass term for those adjoint fermions phi. But that mass term would, which we're not putting in, would break this U1 symmetry. Okay, so we leave it out. So given this U1 symmetry, it's the most general renormalizable Lagrangian you can write down for a gauge field and an adjoint fermion. And we want to ask about what its non-perturbative behavior could be and how we can use the index in order to see whether or not we have the right idea.
Either a gamma mu or an a mu.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, this should be a slash. Yeah, excuse me. Right. And this slash is a different slash. That means that term's not there. Yeah. Okay. So, I'm just going to say a fact. This theory confines and breaks chiral symmetry, breaks the U1 symmetry spontaneously and explicitly. and has n supersymmetric vacua for gauge group SUN. Okay. And tomorrow, we'll show that we can argue this independently and using the index, and that the two ways of seeing this mesh very nicely. Sorry? Oh, the U1 symmetry, which just rotates that adjoint fermion lambda. So in other words, if you just okay, so it does nothing to the gauge field. The gauge field is an SU, so sorry, G is SUN, but even if it weren't, I mean the U1 part wouldn't act on lambda because it's in the adjoint. So the thing which rotates lambda is just a global symmetry. So lambda goes to e to the I theta times lambda, and a mu just goes to itself. Okay. So tomorrow we'll show that the index really is a powerful thing for demonstrating the non-perturbative behavior of gauge theories. We'll see that we cannot see this in perturbation theory at the perturbative level in the gauge theory at all, and we'll see that we can see it pretty clearly using the index. So thank you. Questions?
When you added the term R before in the Lagrange, why did you assume that it is a dynamical variable? For example, why didn't you assume that it was some function of x or function of psi that would change the equation of motion?
Well, I mean, it does. It is set by the equation of motion for R to be equal to something. But I mean, the real argument is just that you know it's something you can do. I mean, so the way we set up these objects to transform, I mean, I didn't write down a transformation law for R, but that's also determined just by Bianchi identities and so on. But I'll just tell you what it is. It's Q acting on R gives you I think plus I or plus 2i psi dot. Okay. The point is just that any combination of x, psi, and r, which you can write down coming from q dagger on any operator O, will automatically be supersymmetric. You know, will automatically be invariant up to a time derivative when you act with either of these. And since the equations of motion also respect that symmetry, whatever R gets set to by its equations of motion will obey the same transformation law. Okay. So maybe I'll leave that as an exercise. I mean, show that when you solve for R, using its equations of motion, you get the same transformation. Okay, so you get psi dot, and you also have to use the equations of motion for psi. Okay, so psi dot is set equal to something by its equations of motion, so is R, and you can show that those Suzy transformations are the same as those. Okay. Other questions? Yeah. U1 is the R symmetry in this case, right? You can see since it rotates lambda and it doesn't rotate A, so right, one way of noticing that something is an R symmetry is if it rotates the super partners in a multiplet differently from each other. Okay, I haven't really talked about four-dimensional multiplets, so I didn't say that, but that's one way of seeing that this has to be something which also rotates the supercharges Q. Sorry? Oh, but the U1R symmetry is the chiral symmetry here. So I mean, it's not. Remember that even though you can think of this as a supersymmetric gauge theory, you can also just think of it as, you know, an SUN gauge theory with an adjoint Weyl doublet. So I mean, you know, the chiral symmetry is what it is, and then you notice that when you look at this as a supersymmetric theory, it also happens to be the R symmetry that rotates the supercharges Q. But you know, we'll exploit that fact to explore the non-perturbative behavior tomorrow.
What does the word confine?
Oh, confine. I'm sorry. You mean since there are no quarks? By this I mean gluons are confined. Color is confined. So you have, you know, you have this gauge field and this matter field transforming non-trivially under the gauge group. So for instance, for SU2, you know, there are three of these things. There's lambda A, you know, lambda A for A equals 1, 2, and 3. The three, you know, one for each generator of the gauge group SU2. And then what you'll see, you know, so by confinement, I just mean that everything in the actual spectrum of the theory, all actual particle states of the non-perturbative theory are singlets under the gauge group. So by confinement, in that sense, I mean the same thing as I mean for QCD. You know, there are nothing but color singlets in QCD, and I mean the same thing for this theory. And the theory does have a mass gap too, and yeah, right.
Mass gap.
Oh, energy gap is right. Energy gap. Zero is isolated in the energy spectrum, so states don't. There are no states with the spectrum of energies does not cluster to zero. Okay.
Is
there? Okay, right. So in this theory, the two sort of go together. You're right. Actually, not only are they logically independent, we'll even hopefully get to some n equals 1 gauge theories where we can use techniques of this kind to show that you have one and not the other. Okay, so they're actually independent. Not in this theory. Okay. Will we be able to prove that absolutely rigorously? No, but we'll be able to, you know, we'll be able to show that the effective theory, which has sort of a mass term for this condensate, is what we think it is. So we'll be able to sort of argue for it on general effective field theory terms, and then we'll be able to really flesh out those intuitions using the index and show that they're right. Okay. So more questions? Stefan, yeah.
What would happen if you didn't project out fermions with negative felicity?
Then the theory wouldn't be supersymmetric, because right. I mean, good question. If you had a Dirac spinner transforming in the adjoint, then there would be more. Well, for instance, there would be more physical boson states, more physical fermion states than boson states with a given color, with a given momentum. And, you know, tomorrow when we talk about the 4D case more generally, we'll see that, you know, that shouldn't happen, okay, in a supersymmetric theory. Yeah, more questions? Yeah.
So, how does the exclusive P1 break take place? Is it through a normalizability effect?
How does the which breaking? Oh, the U1, the chiral symmetry breaking. Oh, so by explicit, I don't mean like a mass term. I mean there'll be an anomaly, which breaks it down to a discrete subgroup. I'm stepping on all my lines from tomorrow, but they were going to be from today. So there'll be an anomaly which breaks it down to a discrete subgroup, and then and then we'll show, using sort of genericity arguments, and then also using the index, that the discrete part gets spontaneously broken too. Okay.
Do you assume the space time is compact?
Oh no, the space time is just four dimensions.
Compact.
Non-compact. 3 plus 1 Lorentz invariant space. Yeah. More questions? Yeah.
How do you know, again, that the Q and lambda have the same U1 charge?
Oh, good. So when we do representations of four-dimensional theories, we'll see that the transformation law of the gauge field A, it just goes that the commutator of Q with A is some gamma matrices dotted into lambda. And so since A can't have any global charges, we know that Q and lambda have to have the same charge. Okay. More questions? Okay, thanks very much.